Let's hear it for Tom Harkin, one of the greatest senators in the U.S. Senate now and ever. Now, Tom, you got to repeat after me. It's chutzpah. Anyway, I think everybody knows how good we've all had it with Tom Harkin as senator. Tom's a trusted friend to me, a mentor, a colleague, someone who can work so hard and keep his beliefs and yet persuade others to work with him and enact amazing policy that helps people, all people. He's a champion for those who need a champion, the poor, the disabled, the young, the old. Just last month, you may have seen it, he was hula hooping outside the Capitol to talk about universal pre-K. Now, Tom may be retiring, but he can move his hips with the best of them. And make no mistake, Tom is the best of them. His accomplishments over the past 38 years, when you read them, they make your hair stand on end. They are so incredible. He fights every year to increase funding for students with disabilities. He was the lead author of the ADA, the American Disabilities Act. He's still trying to persuade our mayor in New York City to buy taxis that help the disabled. He so believes this so passionately. And, you know, Iowans, don't worry. We know Tom's leaving, but you don't have to worry about him coasting through his senior year. As Tom mentioned, because of his leadership, we are going to pass, after a 17-year lapse, ENDA, the non-discrimination, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, because of Tom Harkin. Typical of Tom, it's his bill, it's his proposal, but one of the junior members who cared about it, Jeff Merkley, who's up in 2014, will be the lead sponsor. He's not only a leader, he's just a generous soul. So thank you so much for sending us Tom Harkin. And I want to thank Tom and you for making sure that seat stays in Democratic hands. I have to tell you, if you had to pick someone to follow in Tom's large footsteps, it would be Bruce Braley. I'm looking forward to working with him on keeping college affordable for families, to address sexual assault, domestic violence, and all the other issues that he has talked about. And as two Brooklyn guys in the Senate, we're going to knock them dead, Bruce. Now, I want to recognize other elected officials here tonight. Neil Smith, who was greatly helpful to me when I got to the Senate, and Chairman Brennan mentioned that Neil Smith is probably the only one in the room who had a $2 bill in his wallet and gave, put it in the pot. He didn't mention that Thomas Jefferson gave it to him. I want to thank Dave Loebsack. I've seen Dave work in the Congress. He does a great job. I didn't know you were such a great, as they say in Brooklyn, orator. I want to thank Tom Miller, Mike Grunstall, Pam Yoakum, Mark Smith for being here, and I want to thank Scott Brennan for inviting me and extending such a warm Hawkeye welcome to Iris and I as well. So, ladies and gentlemen, like Tom and Bruce and all of you, I've spent many, many years surveying the political landscape, trying to discern the mood of the electorate, evaluating candidates. It's a tough business, but it can also be a rewarding one, especially when you find that special candidate who inspires you, dares you to realize your dreams. You here in the room know exactly what I mean. 6 years ago, Iowans found that inspiration in Barack Obama. In him you saw hope, and you said, yes, we can. Well, as hard as it may be to admit, the 22nd Amendment tells us that we soon must look toward the future. And while it yet may be early, I want to take this opportunity to let you and the political world know that I have found my 2016 candidate. Now, this may not be much of a surprise, but my candidate, hopefully our candidate, is a virtual guarantee to deliver victory for our party in 2016. Our candidate has the ability and desire to galvanize the political center, both Reagan Democrats and Clinton Republicans, uniting them behind the Democratic ticket, vanquishing the GOP on the road to permanent status. Women who rarely vote or haven't voted for a Democrat in years will flock to the polls to pull the Democratic lever. Young voters of 2016 will experience the motivation a previous generation felt in 2008. And the best part is, history tells us that this candidate is perfectly suited to succeed in the Iowa caucuses. So let's all stick together and make sure that Ted Cruz is the Republican candidate in 2016. Now, with Ted Cruz at the top of the ticket, fooled you, didn't I? We'll be certain that the keys to the White House will stay in Democratic hands. And I know you're all familiar with Senator Cruz. Just last week, he visited the Hawkeye State to further his bid for the GOP nomination and to hunt. Now, frankly, I didn't know why he felt the need to come to Iowa to hunt. He's doing a great job picking off Republican seats for us right now in Washington. Some say he's the candidate of the Tea Party's dreams. He may be the candidate of ours as well. Now, seriously, I am honored to be here tonight. As Tom mentioned, as a kid from Brooklyn, I've always had an affection for Iowa. Not in a I want to run for president type of way. I'm happy being a senator, but we'll discuss that later. This was more like a fascination with rural America. Growing up in an urban neighborhood, I had many goals, an early bucket list that I wanted to accomplish, things that you might take for granted in Iowa, but in urban Brooklyn, they seemed exotic. One was to eat a fish I caught, cleaned, and cooked all by myself. It took me to my mid-20s to get that one done. I also wanted to go hunting. And at long last, 3 years ago, your neighbor and Tom and my former colleague, Ben Nelson, took me on a trip. They actually said I bagged 3 pheasants, but I think that Ben was behind me shooting those pheasants and saying I got them. Anyway, it took me till I was 56. Another goal was to visit all 50 states. I'm still working on that one. I've been to 44. But perhaps my most sought-after goal, my most longed-for goal, one that I dreamed about, literally, since I was a little child, was to see the real America. And to me, the real America meant driving across rural Iowa. I realized that goal in the year 2000, when as a freshman, Senator, I asked my colleague and friend, Tom Harkin, to plan a trip for me and my family. Tom, with his usual, his characteristic kindness and diligence, planned a beautiful trip. We spent a week driving Route 3 from one end of Iowa to the other. As Tom mentioned, we started in Dyersville with its beautiful Field of Dreams, had lunch at Bob and Helen Holmes' farm, visited Jim and Mary Gustafson's hog farm. The aroma still hasn't left me. And I'm still from Brooklyn. I've lived through garbage strikes. I saw my first group of modern windmills at Storm Lake and finished at what was called the world's largest ice cream factory, the Blue Bunny Factory in Lamar. Now, everywhere we went, we stopped along the road and talked to Iowans at lunch counters, drugstores, and on their farms. I found your fellow Hawkeyes to be kind and hardworking, American in the best sense of the word. The beauty of the countryside, quiet strength of the people of Iowa helped deepen my understanding of why America has been and will continue to be the greatest country in the world. That experience makes me even more grateful to be here tonight. I know that this dinner has a long and storied tradition. The list of Iowa JJ speakers has always represented our party's best and brightest, our best hopes for the future. And in spite of that tradition, you all asked me to speak. I'm grateful. But I just hope I can get out of town before one of your Republican Senate candidates tries to convert me. I have to admit, I was a little shocked last July when one of the Republicans vying for the chance to lose to Bruce next November, David Young, he said he wanted to sit down with me and share some good news. Now, I originally thought that meant he wanted to tell me he decided to support increasing the minimum wage, implementing health care, closing corporate loopholes, but apparently Mr. Young had something else in mind. That got some attention back in New York, but don't worry. The columnist Jonathan Chait commented, quote, "Schumer's also a really good negotiator, and Young could walk out of the room having agreed to become a Jew." In spite of that risk, I feel blessed to be here. Especially blessed to be outside of D.C. tonight. As I'm sure you all know, D.C. has been a nightmare lately, a nightmare of gratuitous political dysfunction, purposefully caused by a small number of senators and congressmen. Fortunately for us, the vast majority of Americans know what happened and they know what caused it. They know that the Tea Party drove the nation and the world to the brink of default, risking economic collapse. They know the Tea Party irresponsibly shut down the government in pursuit of an undesirable and unachievable result. They emboldened our competitors like China, who urged all nations to accelerate the pursuit of a world where America does not play a crucial role. They cruelly and needlessly put 800,000 government workers and others out of work, and in one fell swoop, the party that once obsessed on the term job creators had become the job annihilation party. Americans know that a recovery needs policies that put helium in the balloon, not sandbags on the basket. Yet the Tea Party insists on weighing down the middle class at every turn. Most troublingly, they held hostage the very functioning of the government and the full faith and credit of the United States, and blithely put at risk America's gold standard economic reputation, a reputation it took this country 237 years to earn as the reserve currency of the world's financial system. This reputation is a cornerstone of American power at home and abroad, and putting it at risk over political gamesmanship was beyond irresponsible. Economists and business leaders from every corner of the globe and every political persuasion understand that the consequences of default would have been almost unquantifiable and certainly irreversible. Yet to these few Tea Party activists and elected officials, economic theory is heresy. These members of the Flat Earth Society would have you believe that America's standing in the world didn't matter. Fortunately, under the leadership of President Obama, Majority Leader Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi, and the few non-Cruz-infused senators in the GOP conference, we were able to ward off calamity and keep America on its righteous path. Perhaps the only good thing to arise out of this debacle is the self-inflicted damage it did to the Republican Party, where recent polls show their rankings plunging faster than the stock market did under George W. Bush. The astonishing fact is that in the end, it was a shockingly small group of people who did this. One small faction in one part of one branch of government. That wasn't much of a surprise in Washington, where we've seen this small faction use their style of politics. I call it bludgeon politics. Here's what bludgeon politics is. If I don't get my way, all of it, I'll hurt a lot of innocent people and the reputation of our country, so you better give me what I want. In the past, when the Tea Party created gridlock, no one focused on them. The general reaction of most people to gridlock, even the media, was, can't you two parties just get together and solve your problems? That helped the Tea Party, because even though they were the cause of the gridlock, the American people and even the media weren't focusing the blame on where it belonged. But this time, it was different. This time, the ideological battle was waged in full view of the American people, who, for the first time, saw the true nature and intentions of this faction. They saw the faction's resolve to pursue its agenda, no matter the cost to the economy or the populace. The American people found bludgeon politics, with its willingness to hurt innocent people and America's reputation, to be extremely distasteful, to say the least. The Tea Party faction of the Republican Party lost that battle. Unfortunately, I fear it won't be the last. Being ideologues, they are slow to learn, slow to admit the truth. And they've made clear they want to stop President Obama at every turn. Their formidable machine of money and media, old and new, and their successful tactic of intimidating and even threatening Republicans who won't go along with them make it likely that their dominance of the Republican Party will continue for a while. On the plus side, if the Tea Party continues to keep its grip on the Republican Party, I think we can safely predict they'll lose the election of 2016 dramatically and will be hurt in 2014 as well, just as they lost the election of 2012. Maybe they'll come to their senses. However, when an ideological group takes such a grip over the party, it's a hard thing to do, and it takes a while. So, what do we do? One vital action Democrats can take to accelerate the process is to better understand and address some of the forces that fuel and sustain the Tea Party. Here is the main point where Democrats must do better. We have not tapped into and constructively directed the legitimate anger and angst in America out there. The anger and angst is rooted in one essential, vital fact. For the first time in American history, in all of our history, middle-class incomes have declined for over a decade. Over the period from 1999 to 2012, middle-class incomes actually declined. The median income dropped at least 10% since 1999. That's an astoundingly large amount. If you're a family trying to put food on the table, save some money for the kids' college, and maybe put a few dollars away for one modest vacation each year, you know how devastating a 10% drop can be. Many people assume incomes went down for the middle class because of the recession. In fact, middle-class incomes were going down before the recession hit. But that troubling fact was hidden by the fact that average incomes went up. Think back to your high school mathematics, and you'll remember that averages can be skewed. The person who revealed this to all of America was none other than Elizabeth Warren, who was then a college professor and is now our colleague in the Senate. She pointed out that if someone made $10 million in 2001 and made $30 million in 2007, they would pull the average up even if most everyone else stayed stagnant. However, median income, which affects the middle class, declined during all those years. And I want to mention, with so many friends of labor in the room, to me, the number one median income is declining is the assault on labor. Make no mistake about it. And probably the thing that would do more than just about anything else to bring middle class incomes back up, I'll talk about other ways later, is to get card check done, which Tom Harkin and I so valiantly labored for, and allow union membership to go up once again in America. Anyway, you don't need the data, and Americans don't need the data. You feel it. The average American feels it. And it probably keeps you up at night that middle class incomes are declining the way it keeps me up at night. The average middle class American simply doesn't make as much, isn't as able to climb the economic ladder of success, can't provide as much for his or her family as used to. Naturally, that means Americans have less optimism about the future for themselves and their children than they did 10 years ago. This is an important and salient fact, and Democrats have simply not paid enough attention to it. You know, in the city that I represent, there's a beautiful lady. She's in the harbor. She holds a beautiful torch. And the torch to just about every American represents the American dream. If you ask the average American what is the American dream, they wouldn't put it in fancy or highfalutin or professorial language. They'd say it simply. They'd say the American dream, it means that if I work hard, I'll be doing better in 10 years than I'm doing today, and the odds are even higher, my kids will be doing better than me. However, if that torchlight flickers, if the American dream doesn't burn brightly in the American breast, we have big problems. The ongoing hangover from the Bush years, the financial meltdown, have contributed to a new reality in which too many Americans are less economically secure today. And that insecurity is a shock to the central nervous system. Generations of Americans have shared the same goal. Their children should have a better life than their parents had. Generations of Americans have worked towards that goal. They've sacrificed so their children could do more, experience more, inspire more. Americans, my friends, are a beautiful, optimistic, hopeful people. But if middle class incomes continue to decline for the next 5 years, and people no longer believe in the American dream, it's a different country. We have a different America. From the fledgling nation that threw off the yoke of a mighty empire, to the Western expansion, to the Industrial Revolution and waves of immigration, to the defeat of fascism and the spreading of unparalleled, peaceful, and prosperous world visions, we have always had a sense that our best was yet to come. But for too many, complicated economic headwinds have caused a wariness to creep into our sense of optimism about the future. And we, as a party, ignore that at our peril. Americans know recovery is working for the better off. They know that the well-to-do are back where they were or better from before the meltdown. And they resent that it hasn't fully manifested itself for them. And it's not that the American people aren't generous. They are. We are. We don't mind if someone else's income goes up 20% as long as ours is going up. And by the way, that's different than most countries. It's an amazing thing about America. Felix Rowetin, the famous New York banker who spent his youth in France, once articulated to me the difference between the American character and the French character. Here's what Felix said. He said, in America, when Joe Bailey, typical American, wins the lottery, the average American says, great. Joe and his family are set for life. But when Pierre Dupont, the typical Frenchman, wins the lottery, the average Frenchman says, that Pierre, he must have cheated. I deserve to win. Americans don't begrudge the successful, but they do expect a fair share of the prosperity. What's different now is that the middle class and the working class and those struggling to get there simply aren't sharing in the prosperity like they used to. Americans don't want to be forced to settle for jobs that pay them less than what they used to make. Young Americans are tired of jobs that don't pay enough to live on, jobs that force them to live at home with mom and dad. American mothers are tired of doing the math after they get a job offer, realizing they're making pennies an hour after they factor in childcare costs, not to mention eating and transportation and buying professional clothes. American parents are tired of stressing over how they'll afford to send their kids to college. Americans are tired of worrying that they won't be able to leave their kids better off than their parents left them. They simply don't want to be the first generation to let that happen. We know people are tired and frustrated and angry. The Tea Party's emergence and strength stems from this anger. And if we don't rechannel it into constructive and effective solutions, America will be a different, more sour, less successful place for a generation. Let me explain. When Americans get to a place when they're upset and angry, there are two paths that lead them out. One is the path our party has always taken: substantive programs where government works with private industry to provide a path so the middle class can do better. It's a positive path based on actually addressing the middle class's problems. Great Democrats have done this throughout history. Woodrow Wilson did it in the Progressive Era. Franklin Roosevelt did it in the 30s and got us out of the Depression. Harry Truman did it as America transitioned into a post-war society. John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson did it as they helped make a better world for the old and the young. Bill Clinton did it when he had constructive solutions to help our economy grow while shrinking the deficit. And Barack Obama took this path with the advent of the Affordable Care Act and his efforts to guide America out of the recession. We Democrats have always appealed to the better angels of people's nature. But unfortunately, there's a dark side to the American character. When things get bad, there are always those who appeal to our lesser instincts, to fear and to anger and to negativity and to division. That is where the Tea Party finds its appeal. Unfortunately, because we Democrats have not fully fulfilled and answered people's anger as effectively as we might, this Tea Party has gained too much traction. It is ironic, of course. They exploit this anger even while their actual policies, like cutting investment just when we should be increasing it, taking cops and firefighters and teachers off the job and shutting down the government, are actually preventing the recovery from realizing its full potential. And that's why we need to do better. We need to address the root causes of that anger and angst, but do it by appealing to Americans' natural optimism. The Tea Party tried to frighten people into believing that Armageddon is constantly around the corner, and they effectively use hatred of the government, as a scapegoat to channel people's anger toward the evildoers who are, quote, creating your problems and robbing you of your freedoms. But we all know, it's obvious, although it's not stated. It's not just anti-government favor making government a scapegoat for the fears and ills that people have. Beneath it, there's an underlying of other forces at work. America has dramatically changed, and Tea Party members don't like it. They don't like the fact that white Anglo-Saxon men are not exclusively running the country anymore. President Obama lost the white male vote 35-62, yet he recaptured the presidency by 5 million votes and a resounding electoral college margin. More profoundly, only 1 in 10 GOP voters were non-white. They don't like the fact that African Americans and Latinos and Asians will soon be a majority in this country. They don't like the fact that over the last 30 years, women have taken an increasing role in our society and in our government, and that LGBT people have made remarkable progress towards equality. They know it's a different America. It looks different. It prays different. It works different. To them, that is unsettling. They long for the old days. They wish to pull America back. Even technology has stoked the fears of those to whom the Tea Party appeals. Parents watch their kids go on the internet and do and see things the parents never imagined doing or seeing and would never have permitted their kids to do, but now they can't stop it. The pace of information and communication is dizzying. Just a few years ago, parents could put one computer in the house by the kitchen and keep an eye on things. Now, every kid has a full-on computer in her or his pocket with a smartphone or tablet. Who kids played with was, from time immemorial, defined by where you live. But now, with social media, that model's out the window. Along with the ability for many to track, even roughly, what their kids are doing and with whom. So the Tea Party, in a sense, when they attack government, when they attack Obamacare, or they attack immigration reform, is really saying, we don't like the way America is changing. We want to bring it back to the way it used to be. Now, this is not the first time this has happened in America. There have been other times in history, usually when change is fast, that a core group appeals to negative instincts and fears and says, let's pull it back. In Iowa, you'll appreciate this moment of history. The turn of the 20th century was a time like that, and there's a great book by a University of Chicago professor, Edward Shills, who wrote about the temperance movement. Shills said that the temperance movement was about much more than abolishing liquor, just as the Tea Party is about a lot more than just shrinking government. In the 1880s, the U.S. was a rural country. People were on farms in small towns living a clean, God-fearing life. By 1920, America had become urbanized and diversified because of manufacturing, immigration, and everything else. The cities were a totally different way of life, with slums and bars and dance clubs, emerging suburbs and country clubs where people drank. Prohibition was really an attempt by rural America to pull their country back to a Jeffersonian agricultural ideal that was being rapidly replaced by a new cultural and economic reality. The Tea Party's trying to do the same thing. They see an America that's not reflective of themselves, and they just don't like it. So the Tea Party taps into the legitimate anger and fear average Americans have because of the declining economy, and they mischannel it into a counterproductive and negative hatred. This hatred, allegedly directed at the government, masks an anger at a newer, and most of us believe, better America. So the middle class is hurting, and that hurt can take two paths. The path of the Tea Party, of negativity to government, hostility to others not like them, and an ostrich-like denial of the changes in the world. Or it can take the positive path, which allows middle-class incomes to grow, the creation of new and better jobs, and an optimistic view that your children are going to do better than you did. Part of the reason, I repeat this because I think we have to listen and make ourselves better. Part of the reason the Tea Party has had such confounding success is that we Democrats have not been as effective as laying out our positive vision. Democrats must do a better job at proffering a positive vision and agenda that helps middle-class incomes advance and rallies the middle class and those aspiring to be middle class, that appeals to the better instincts with constructive solutions rather than divisiveness, fear-mongering, and finger-pointing in which the Tea Party is specialized. I don't have time this evening to document that agenda in detail, but I'm going to briefly describe four things we must do. It's not a complete list, just a few things that we have to do to move America forward. I mentioned card check already. I don't think we should give up on that. It's too important for the future of America. But here are four others. The first is education. Tom has done so much in this area. I know he has so much more that he wants to do before he leaves the Senate. We must improve K-12 education. And in this area, as Tom has shown on his committee, There's effective bipartisan compromise potential. The conservative movement believes in standards. Standards should not, students, they say, should not be promoted from third to fourth grade if they read at a first grade level. Fair enough. But we Democrats believe our education system deserves more investment to achieve that goal. In the 21st century, teaching has to be considered a glorified and exalted profession. And the starting salary for a teacher should not be $35,000 a year. It's outrageous. Well, why don't we marry the two? We'll pay teachers a lot more. In return, school districts can adopt standards that make sure students graduate with the skills they need to get good-paying jobs or move on to college. The federal government could pay for the increased salaries, freeing the middle class from the tyranny of rising property taxes of every local school district that voluntarily adopts those standards. And when it comes to college, Tom and Bruce have both worked so well on this, we have to make it more affordable. I created the American Opportunity Tax Credit. It gives middle-class families a $2,500 break as they pay for college. We must do more. We have to get interest rates low. Protect the dream of being able to send your son or daughter to college. For too many, as tuition costs rise and incomes fall, the dream is slipping out of reach. Second piece of this is immigration reform. I'm not going to get into all the details. It's something passionate for Tom and I and for both our mentor, the mentor to both of us who's looking down, making sure we get this done, Ted Kennedy. But nothing will better spark the economy than the hard work of immigrants as we legalize them. It'll provide a tremendous jolt to our economic growth. The Congressional Budget Office, a nonpartisan agency, estimates that if the Senate bipartisan immigration bill passed, it would increase GDP growth by 3.3% in the first decade and 5.4% over 20 years, all while creating over 5 million new jobs spanning every industry, from high tech to manufacturing to agriculture. This is more GDP growth, my friends, than any Republican program of tax cutting and any Democratic program of government spending, and it's obvious why, which our Tea Party friends can't see. When immigrants, whether they're PhDs from India or day laborers from Mexico, work hard to make a decent living for their families, they help us grow economically, and we should harness that opportunity for economic growth. The third, investing in our infrastructure. No program creates jobs, raises middle-class incomes, and helps the economy more than infrastructure, roads and bridges and water and sewer, but also the more efficient power grids and better and quicker broadband everywhere, the modern infrastructure. And infrastructure, broadly defined, means investing in scientific infrastructure, again, which Tom has fought so well for, NIH, NSF Research. There are two industries in which America totally dominates the globe, high-tech and pharmaceuticals. This would not be the case if over the years the government had not funded NSF, the pure research there created the high-tech industry, and NIH, the pure research there funded the pharmaceutical industry. And finally, last, not least, on this little list, is making the tax code more fair. One that closes corporate loopholes, makes sure people who are wealthy finally pay their fair share, and eases the all-too-great burden on the poor and the middle class, both of whom pay a higher percentage of their income as taxes than the wealthy do. Surely we can agree we should eliminate tax benefits for oil companies as well as companies that undermine the economy by shipping jobs overseas. So we Democrats, we have very good policies in these important areas. We have to refine them, hone them, focus on them, and get our American people, middle class and those aspiring, to understand how important they are and why we're pursuing them. And one final point. We also need to continue our tradition of good leaders who can convey these ideas and connect with the middle class. Earlier, I shared with you my preferred Republican candidate. Well, I don't want to leave here tonight with also discussing the Democratic field. Not that I want to accelerate the 2016 cycle, I don't. I'm as tired as anyone of the permanent election cycle. However, the Democratic Party is blessed with a great deal of talent these days. Our bench has breadth and depth. We have talent in the state houses, the governor's mansions, the House and the Senate. We have a number of stars who would make terrific candidates and terrific presidents. But I believe the candidate I have in mind is the right person to build upon President Obama's tremendous successes and continue to move this country forward. I believe my candidate has the experience and vision to guide this country through these anxious times. A few years ago, I wrote a book about the middle class, focused on a family I called the Baileys. Maybe some of you may remember it. It's called Positively American. The good news about my book is none other than Newt Gingrich said that if Democrats followed it, they'd be the majority party for a generation. The bad news is no one bought it. I have plenty of free copies. Call Tom and I'll get you a free one. Anyway, you probably know this family. The Baileys are a suburban, two-income family with three kids in the local public schools. They're optimistic by nature, but finances are a nagging worry. They are America's swing voters. The candidate I have in mind instinctively understands the Baileys, and I believe that understanding will be the key to our winning the presidency in 2016. Earlier I told you I'm not here to run for president, and I know the relief in this room is palpable. What I haven't told you yet is why. You see, I actually have run for president once before, in junior high school. It was a good, clean campaign. We met the voters over chocolate milk and tater tots. We focused on the issues. I think we raised the level of discourse in the cafeteria and in the playground. But when I eventually lost to Mady Gilson, not that I still remember her name, when I lost to her, I said then, as I say now, it's time for a woman to be president. And so, tonight, here in Iowa, and I won't get this opportunity again, I am urging Hillary Clinton to run for president. And when she does, she will have my full and unwavering support. You know her well, First Lady, Senator, Secretary, and as wife and mother, Hillary's experience is unrivaled and unparalleled. Suffice it to say, my friends, 2008 was the right time for Barack Obama. He successfully navigated this country through some choppy waters, and he'll continue to do so for the next 3 years. But 2016 is Hillary's time. Run, Hillary, run! If you run, you'll win, and we'll all win. So, ladies and gentlemen, with a strong platform, with Hillary leading the charge, we will vanquish Ted Cruz, Tea Party Republicans in 2016, and create a generation of Democrats who will make sure the middle class and the poor get what they need as our country advances and the torch held by that beautiful lady in New York's harbor will burn more brightly than ever. Thank you for having me. God bless you. God bless America. Thank you.